Welcome to another Electron Dance podcast. I'm Joel Goodwin, also known as HM of Electron Dance, and talking with me today from Austin, Texas, is Sheldon Pacote. Sheldon is best known for being the writer on Deus Ex and its sequel Invisible War, but has recently broken into indie gaming with a title called Cell Emergence, where he was the lead designer and programmer. Welcome, Sheldon Pacote. How are you doing?
Great.
So I think it's midnight there and 6 a.m. here, so fortunately that'll mean probably both of us can't string two words together. I'll just start off with asking you, who are you? What is it you actually do on a day-to-day basis apart from indie game development?
Okay, well, I have a biography that makes not a whole lot of sense. I do a lot of different things. I've done a lot in games, a lot of writing in games. For about a decade, I was primarily a writer and a designer for video games. Worked on Deus Ex and the sequel to that, an America's Army game where I did some writing and a little bit of design. I came on as a systems designer, right. But there was quite a bit of systems design already done when I joined, so I can't take too great of a claim on the systems of that game. Worked for a bit on an MMO called Auto Assault. In my home state of Colorado, and I could go talk about that game a bit. I think that had a lot more going for it than I think the market saw, I think partly because of the title and some of the ways it was marketed. And I worked for a bit at Junction Point on games like Ninja Gold and Epic Mickey. So I've done a lot of game stuff. I teach game writing at the University of Texas, and I do some software development lately. I've been working at a consulting company called Frog as a technical architect, doing that to keep the burn rate of my household under control. and then indie stuff lately.
So it's kind of interesting how I always assumed, you know, because you're put down as the principal writer for Deus Ex, that's what you were. And if you look at your actual website, then all it really talks about is writing. There's a little bit about, I think it mentions asteroids, but generally right. it's writing. So are you, originally, would you say you're a writer or a developer?
Well, I think my biggest passion is writing. I spent most of my 20s really not very employed, sort of half employed, and living in a small room in a house in Austin, paying about $270 a rent a month, which is pretty low in America. And just writing most of the time, reading big books. I'd wake up any random time of the day and go sit in a coffee shop and read Ulysses or something. And so that's my first love. And that's where I put most of my creative energy when I was younger. And that led right into games. And because I have such a strong software background, I think that was a really nice fit on Deus Ex. So I got that opportunity partly because because Ion Storm was looking for somebody who could, you know, handle the logic of a branching narrative as well as, you know, write something for it. So I think it's a great place where the two come together, and I'd like to, you know, continue exploring, you know, that side of games at some point. I've kind of shied away from doing anything too experimental with story in games because I think I would go really deep. You know, having, you know, software background, I would be one of those people who would build their story engine, right? And you see them once in a while come along, a game designer or someone that has a story platform or something, and I would probably do the same thing, and I don't know if it would come out to be any kind of industry tool. It would be a very, very big, complicated project. I think I would like to have some production value behind it, so I want to do it at the right time when I can really, you know, devote hours and resources to it.
Yeah. So do you have any ideas along those lines, or is it simply like a big empty box? Or, oh, yeah, that's the kind of thing I'd like to do.
Well, yeah, I liked the experiment that came along a few years ago called Facade, where I don't know if you remember that title.
It was an academic project essentially, wasn't it? It came out of was it Santa Cruz?
Sounds about right. Yeah.
And it's just basically it's an experiment in sort of. Proper conversation with computer AI, isn't it? It's two people sort of you come over for a dinner party or something, you just got to talk to them and with text basically, and it's an FPS without guns.
Right. Yeah, so it's an interesting experiment. I show it to my class every semester and we look at it, and you know, I don't know if that's the engine I would build, but I like that the notion of a very granular interaction with another character and intimate character responses with facial expressions and composed responses. I think it'd be all fun stuff to play with. I think that that title itself suffers a bit from the theme that was chosen. You know, you're kind of with this grumpy couple and they kind of, you know, I think that the emotional turn that happens is maybe it doesn't really sock you in the gut the way maybe I think the developers hoped it would. I don't know. Somehow it's just not quite the subject matter doesn't quite gel. And so I'd love to do something with a game that's complex in that way with AI and logic. And try to compose something that's really smooth and expressive.
Right. How did you actually get into game development in the first place?
Well, it is something that I've always thought I'd wanted to do. And when I was, you know, once again back in my wild 20s, I came across a company in Austin called Human Code that did a lot of game development. And they were more on the multimedia edutainment side of things, but I actually got my first job. And you mentioned Asteroids on my website. That was the work sample I turned in for it. There was a project called FutureNet, which had Bruce Sterling signed on to do the writing, and Sid Mead, who did the concept art for Blade Runner, was signed on to do the artwork for it. And it was a really exciting, awesome project. And so that I was asked to program tic-tac-toe to prove that I could write code. And so I was actually applying for a lead programmer position and decided, you know, I was excited enough about it that I just kind of dove in and spent about 4 or 5 days and programmed Asteroids in what was called Director back in those days, Macromine Director. Uh-huh. So it was, you know, kind of a cool technical spike, so to speak, you know, for the time. And got in and did that. And actually, that project, like, I got my first taste of the game business. That project was canceled within the first month that I was at the company. And after that, I actually did a writing for a multimedia project that they had that was a sequel to a game based on the weather for the Discovery Channel. And that was a lot of fun. I got a taste of writing and working with live actors and putting together a multimedia game, which gave me another taste of the game business when it was canceled after it was complete. It was pretty much in the can. And Discovery Channel kind of canceled that line of products. And I won't go into too much detail, I guess, but one more project after that at that studio was Wishbone and the Amazing Odyssey, where I actually was the lead programmer on it. And during that project, I decided that wasn't really the role I wanted in the game business. You know, so I kind of dropped out of the game business for a while until I could come back in as a writer.
After Deus Ex and its sequel, then I wouldn't say your name disappeared entirely, but to this day, people still refer to you as the Deus Ex writer and don't mention anything else. Have you got the projects in the last 10 years that you were really looking for? Or is it, you know, were you looking for another Deus Ex, or are you kind of happier doing something which hasn't created such a massive, you know, impact in games?
Well, I think you're always looking for the amazing, unique, new project to work on. And there's a ton of people in the game business. In fact, most people, I know a lot of them, good friends of mine, very, really talented developers who never get that project. You know, they work on licensed properties or, you know, smaller properties, handheld games and this and that. And they never have that breakout project. Mm. So I'm thrilled to have been on, you know, was, you know, the perfect project for me at the time, you know, a game full of all these different voices to write and, you know, high culture, low culture and everything. And a team that just, you know, there's a lot of tensions on the team itself, but just was the right group of people at the right time to put together, you know, the right game at the right stage in the evolution of games. You know, it was kind of a rich story, and a shooter at that time was a pretty unique concept. So, you know, in the years after that, I had a really good time at the studio I was at in San Francisco at Secret Level, working on the Army game, working with Special Forces soldiers to come up with missions and write the dialogue for them. That was actually thrilling. It wasn't a big game. It didn't get a lot of attention, but as a writer, it was the best experience I could have asked for in terms of, you know, especially for writing, you know, computer game type stuff, adventure. Yeah. Type stuff. Everybody wants to write about war and soldiers and whatnot. And it was wonderful having these guys basically make fun of our writing at times. You know, there was one time visiting us we were all in the kitchen. The whole development team was there, and the three soldiers were there. And these are like, you know, the top soldiers, right? One of the guys rode into Kabul with Hamid Karzai, right? So like heroes. You see this. You see actually one of the guys. His name is Jason Ammerman. You'll see him on like MSNBC and stuff once in a while. So I mean, the guys know their stuff, and so they're reading our dialogue, and we do the typical game developer stuff where it's like. So you got to get up on top of that hill. When you get there, you got to push this button. You got to do this. You got to do that. And they started reading some of this stuff. And I'm like, come on, what is this stuff? And they're just all chuckling and laughing. And no, they would know their mission. They would get here and they'd say, Alpha up, Bravo up, move out. You know, that's all they would say. And so that helped us understand, you know, really what they're doing when you know, soldiers are out on a mission, and helped us structure the game. You know, we added tutorial or not tutorial, but mission briefing segments, which. You know, somewhat non-interactive, and probably a lot of game designers would shy away from doing exactly what we did, but it's exactly what soldiers would do. They would study the mission before they ever got out there, learn about it, and then go do it. So good experiences, you know, and it's kind of haphazard what projects you end up on and, you know, what cities you want to live in. One of the reasons I haven't pursued writing, per se, in games is that to really make it work, I would want to be an independent consultant, contractor, and that would involve, you know, a variable income, and I'd need to be able to be very mobile and be able to kind of go where the work was. And I've got kids and family and stuff, and that would be the ideal job, really. If I was 23 now and I was the lead writer on Deus Ex, I mean, I'd just set up shop as an independent writer and kind of fly here and there for the projects and then take time off when there was downtime, and it'd be awesome. Yeah. But it's... That particular role, I think, is not really what I want now, and I like, you know, thinking a little more broadly about games. And the reason I kind of dove into indie development is that I just, you know, just wanted to get my hands around a game and try to do something different and you know, complete, you know, try to conceive of a whole project, you know, from top to bottom.
So is New Life Interactive your company?
Right, it is actually. Yeah, so it's a business entity I created for the purposes of developing games. And, you know, other people have been involved as well. For this first title, Cell, most of the development was done by me, so it's been mostly me working on it. And the other folks have come on and, for 3 to 6 month stretches to do asset development for the most part.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the structure of it right now. I mean, over time, I'd like to see it grow and you know, operate as a studio. But... haven't quite pursued that angle. You know, I haven't gone looking for titles. I haven't gone trying to pitch the company as, hey, we can build your DS game for you. It's really just more of an organizational entity right now. I'd like to focus on original work for the near future, at least.
Well, why was it now that you felt there was a time to go indie, say, rather than, say, 2 years ago or 5 years ago?
Well, the funny answer to that is it was about 4 years ago when I decided to go indie. You know, it was when I decided to start tinkering with boxes, basically, you know, voxels, that kind of thing. It was just when the indie channel on Xbox was coming along.
Yeah,
the plans were just put in place to turn it into a, you know, community channel, and you know, people were putting out indie games in other ways at the time, and it just, you know, it's kind of had the itch. And I've been talking, you know, like most game developers do over lunch, they'll have their, like, you know. Ideas for indie games, and always start off, you know, well, if I was going to make an indie game, I would do this and this and this. And I'd been talking for quite a while about using either fractals or Cellular Automata to create a framework for a game that would generate its own interesting imagery and interactions and that kind of thing. And it just felt to me like it could work, you know. And this was before Minecraft or the latest wave of voxel-based games are just everywhere. I never dreamed when I started working on this that this odd, weird concept of taking Cellular Automata and putting it into a game would turn into a giant, you know, flood of product before I ever got the game out. But I was, you know, I was convinced. I knew the complexity was there. I mean, I have a math degree as well, so I knew that the math there contained a lot of just pretty much endless possibilities of what you could do in the game space. And just, you know, wanted to dive in and do it. And so that's kind of why I kind of took a step back from the game business. And like I said, actually, right after that right at that point, I'd also, in the previous 2 years, lived in three different states, you know, Texas, California, and Colorado, and then back to Texas, and was getting a little tired of just kind of, you know, flitting from place to place. So I just decided to kind of do my own thing for a while and settle down.
From what I understand, that you have this sort of belief that you know, the future of games is really trying to handle lots of complexity, you know, simulations with lots of moving parts. So, I mean, you can obviously see that in Cell Emergence, where it's based on Cellular Automata, which, just to explain, is a particular kind of mathematical simulation where, if I'm going to be crude about it, it's like every point has its own state. It changes state based on a strict rule set, maybe looking around, it's seeing what its neighbors are. Would you say that's a good characterization of it, you know, in layman's terms?
Yeah, that's a good way for it to, so that you know, everybody can understand what it is. I mean, it really is about the neighbors of a cell. Look, you know, the old example is the Game of Life, you know, Conway's Game of Life, where the rules are purely, you know, if I have two or three neighbors, then I continue living. If I have less than that, I die. If I have more than that, I die. And you get some very complex behaviors come out of that. You can build whole computers and whatnot with these type of structures you can build with these mathematical rules.
Mm.
But in a game setting, you can take that further beyond the strict mathematical definition. And I do some things where the particles might look a couple neighbors abroad, or they might generate events that lead to a sprite being created and that kind of thing. In terms of the future of games, I feel like, just in a very general way, there's going to be so much computing power available eventually, and we're going to want to do something with it. And you know, I'm not sure yet myself what that is. And you know, and with Cell, I did have a belief, and I think it's proved out, that you can use this complexity to generate interesting, you know, visuals for sure, as well as, you know, complex kind of fluid, organic feeling interactions. Mm. It is true that the human brain can't understand the tens of thousands of state changes that are happening every frame in a game like Cell. I mean, really, when you have antibodies percolating through a membrane, every antibody is kind of randomly walking and moving from here to there. The human brain's not going to grasp all that. So even with all of this complexity, there's still the need to shape it on a higher level. And that's kind of what I'm struggling with and learning about as I play with the concept, is, you know, what are those structures that need to be in place to make this amount of complexity and organic behavior fun. The question I'm asking is, are these structures that are in games right now, like a collision cylinder that you shoot at, are these the necessary level of simplicity for human players to engage with a simulation and enjoy it? Or can it go a little deeper? Can you influence something in more incomplete ways? You know, by you're shooting a spaceship. Is it fun if that spaceship starts to melt and burn, like voxel by voxel, and kind of gradually corrode away? Or does that complexity just kind of obscure the game structure? You know, does it then become too random for people? And I'd like to believe that that kind of like real simulation component can be worked into all different kinds of games to make them a little more realistic and to create emergent situations, you know, where things, you know, explode or don't quite die, you know, when you think they would, and somebody has, you know, survives and squeaks through a situation and that kind of thing.
It's interesting that this isn't the first time it's been mentioned in Electron Dance, using cellular automata. It came up last year with, I talked to the author of Boulder Dash, Peter Leeper, and he said that Boulder Dash was essentially cellular automata, with every individual, I suppose you could say, character on the screen has its own life. Boulders can fall and things like that. And I'm just thinking about Cell. It's much more granular than, say, something like Boulder Dash. You can still see these pixels, but they're much smaller. There's a bigger space, and there you're not, how can I put it, as a player, you're not concentrating on the individual voxels. You're actually concentrating on the overall feel of it, what you perceive from this space. So I don't see pixels of voxels of membrane. I see a sheet, and I don't see voxels of the growth, but I actually see this purple growing mass. And I thought that's kind of interesting, because you're having to code up something which is saying how individual voxels behave, but somehow if you tweak these rules so it creates something which is human sensible, And I think Cell's done a really good job of that. But I was wondering, how much effort was it trying to get the actual simulation to work and be something that is that you can appreciate, you know, as a player?
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge in two ways, both a technical front as well as just a design front. Technically, there's just so many ways these things can go wrong, you know. The bugs that I would have, you know, you hear about the nanotech plague that everyone's afraid might happen, where they call it gray goo. Mm. A self-replicator gets out of control and just multiplies and multiplies. And that happened all the time. There'd be some box of a white one or a purple one would somehow get the wrong value in one of its fields, and it would suddenly think it had to multiply every frame for the next 500 frames or something. The whole world would fill up with purple boxes. I had those bugs up till almost the very end. You know, there's still a couple obscure ones down in there. So the rules get pretty cryptic, and they have to be pretty low level because they have to be fast. You know, so you're kind of down inside the data structures, operating on pointers and stripping out colors with byte arithmetic and stuff. So it was a challenge to be at that level. And then at the other side of things, to make rules that weren't that were predictable, basically. And in that sense, you know, I started with the very basic tech demo I have on my site, which I still need to update because I don't think it quite works on ATI cards correctly. But early demo, I first got the technology working, and I let the battles on the cell level be completely random. You know, there's a probability there, so it kind of tilted toward one substance or the other. But what happened was it really was alive in its own way, and the player didn't have enough control to stop it, per se. Mm-hmm. You'd shoot a few things, it had the world full of growing stuff, and get a few bullets in there, and the acid would start to eat away at the growth. But then it would never stop. I discovered this by I was testing my code, and I just left it running for a while. I went outside and was watering the bamboo, I think, for like an hour, and came back in, and it was all still going. The acid was going, and the growth was going. And it was just like population dynamics in nature, you know, deer and hunters or what have you. So it was a great simulation. It was a pretty accurate simulation of how probably bacteria and some other, you know, predator might operate in nature. But it wasn't anything that you'd want to have in a game. I mean, it was a simple case of, I don't know if you'd even call it. I guess it was somewhat of an emergent behaviors, population dynamics emerging from these rules. But it's something that wouldn't work well in a game. So I had to pull back from purely random low-level stuff and try to create stuff that was, you know, that had some behavior that emerged from the rules, but which was, you know, controllable in some way. Or even, you know, I would make it deterministic for a certain number of generations. Like you shoot the acid or whatever it's called in the game. I forget the name myself. Corrosive.
It was something corrosive. Oh gosh, no, I can't remember. Sorry, we'll just say call it the acid. It'll do.
Yeah, that'll do. That's how it was. It's what's called in the code, actually, still. So that make it invincible for like 10 or 12 generations. And so if the player shoots at the purple growth, then they're guaranteed of clearing out a certain area of it. So they have some control.
In terms of your goals, I mean, I can't help thinking of something like Dwarf Fortress, which is alive in a similar sense. I mean, are you familiar with Dwarf Fortress at all?
I actually wasn't aware of the game when I started Cell, but it is right in the vein of kind of where I would like to go with the technology.
Because it does seem to be creating stories all by itself, and in a sense it's not got any sort of narrative built into it because it's so complicated and has so many such an enormous spectrum of potential behavior that stories are just sort of erupting from it, and I just don't. It must be such an effort to keep that thing under control and not suddenly blow up in the same way that your simulation in Cell could when you were trying to tweak it.
Yeah, I think they have a much harder problem than I faced with Cell. At least I could just say, okay, bad stuff growing, good stuff to protect. You know, I was able to keep things pretty simple. My hope for Cell when I started it was really to do an RTS, which would be kind of in the vein of Dwarf Fortress, but my original vision, and before I even written any code, I was on the phone with a friend of mine in New York who's a web developer, and I was saying, man, I've got this great idea for a game. It's all based on boxes in a 3D space, and users will be able to build their own stuff and to design their own weapons and things, and we'll store them and have all this user-generated content. And I wanted to have an RTS that was sort of like an arms race, where there's some basic rules to interact on some kind of a board, you know, fictionalized as a, you know, a cyber attack or a nano war or something, and really have it be about what the users build, what kind of defenses they build, and what kind of weapons they build. So you kind of come to the game with your deck, kind of like, you know, a magic deck or something. Like, okay, I've got my fortress built, and I've got my weapons, and let's see who wins, right?
Yeah.
So I think that was the core of this type of technology that had me excited. It was the fact that you could build anything with these simple components, you know, red, blue, green. And I haven't gotten there yet in terms of games. This first title really was an urge to just get something out with the technology. So at some point, instead of building the full vision that I had for, you know, networked environment and user accounts and you know, persisting objects and all that kind of stuff, I just said, okay, no networking. Let's put out a game that's you know, single player arcade game, and just get this stuff running fast and see what you can do with it.
So let's go back to essentially the story of Cell. Now, I know you made the sort of deliberate decision to sort of rein in the plot, make it more minimalist. You wanted to put in a plot which is just basically does as little as it needs to do and just sort of get out the way. And I did say when I wrote about it that I didn't think there was much potential for a story in a voxel world. But then again, I'm looking back and I'm wondering that's overly harsh considering the sort of emergent behavior you can get out of it. And you do make an effort to link the sort of external story to the internal story about halfway through the game, and there is a sort of thread which carries forward there quite strongly. But I'm just wondering, of course, if you injected too much narrative, you might end up with something like Tidalis, which is basically it's a puzzle game, and there's bags of cutscenes and story between the levels which seem to have very little to do with the actual puzzles themselves. So now I can see there's a lot more to Cell Emergence than the cutscenes say. That they come in and go out, and they don't. Sometimes you're wondering, what was that about? And you have to think about it to understand what these little pieces of dialogue are actually talking about. But I'm just wondering now, looking back at it, now it's completed and out into the world, what's your, you know, post-mortem of it? Do you think it's worked well, or it's too little, too much?
Well, you know, I felt like it was a necessity to have the conceit for the game, you know, to make the player believe they're inside of a body. So I started with that. I wanted to have a story that was just as lean as possible, like you said. I guess I've been messaging that to the press as much as I could, that, hey, this is a very simple story that's in the game. It's just an arcade game story, which I know players hate to have the game stop and then sit and watch a cutscene. So, you know, my favorite cutscene is the second one, where the girl just kind of stirs for a moment and kind of moans and then falls back into unconsciousness. Just kind of just let you know you're inside of a body, or you're saving this girl from a disease, and so that's all I wanted to accomplish. And I would have been completely happy if I could just get the Pac-Man running across the screen real quick to remind you that there's a wider, you know, context. I think, you know, in that sense, I'm happy I kept it lean. I think that I've seen both types of reviews. I've seen reviews where people come down like really on pro side with the story, hey, it's a great story, but I don't really like the gameplay, and then a complete opposite side. But I think the good thing is, I think everybody who's played it doesn't question the fact that they're in a body. At least so far, I haven't heard anybody say, this is totally unbelievable, this isn't cancer, you know. And that was the trick I was really trying to pull off, is that, you know, these are just colored boxes. You know, before I started the title, Cell Emergence per se, that's all it was these colored boxes and different behaviors. And so I wanted to come up with something that had a theme to it, where you really were interacting with T cells and antibodies and all that kind of stuff. So in that sense, I think it's a success. I kind of wish I had maybe skipped ahead in what I see the storyline being, because it's really act one of what I would see as a three-act structure, where this girl grows up with this stuff inside of her, kind of created by this bio-warfare that she kind of got exposed to in some way. And so the next one would be a little more exciting, where she's, you know, more of a teenager or young adult who's now become this object of interest of like mafia groups and international crime syndicates and stuff, and And whenever she gets in a terrible situation, like she's drowned in icy water or something, then the stuff inside of her gets stronger and fights it off. And I was kind of envisioning this, you know, doing a few indie games, kind of building up her as a character and as having the stuff inside of her that has its own intelligence and is really kind of a companion running through her life. So I think there's, you know, I think there's a lot of fiction. There's a lot of backstory there. There's probably too much backstory that's seeping into this particular title that it's just a lot of stuff to process, I think, when a cutscene pops up. And I think that's where a lot of players react, because it is what players hate. You know, it's cutscenes in between, you know, interactive segments, and they are bound to the gameplay. And we saw that as one of the huge challenges, would say, how do we take these cutscenes on the human level and make them relevant to this microscopic, you know, molecular level that you're at? And we've pulled every trick out of a hat we could, you know, by making the sound design react based on the game state, you know, trying to put some subtle cues of the girl's breathing and emotes in there, making the music sync to her heartbeat and stuff. So we did everything we could to tie the two worlds together. But at the end of the day, they're two very different worlds, and I think they clash in many ways.
I think the sound work in the game is pretty good. It does work very well, I think, in terms of the sort of ringing of the bells when things are not going well for you, and definitely the sort of moaning of the patient when the membrane starts being eaten away. I think that's it's because it's muffled. It's very haunting. It's kind of like, oh, I don't like that sound. It does make you feel like you have to, you know, you have to do well here. Otherwise, yes, someone's going to die.
Yeah, I apologize for stressing out so many players with that. I think some players feel very, very, put on the spot or responsible when they lose their first couple levels. Yeah, the sound design was fabulous. I worked with a guy by the name of Robin Arnott. Mm-hmm. And he does great, great stuff. He's built this game based around nothing but sound called Deep Sea, which has gotten a lot of attention. And he was brilliant in getting everything to mesh nicely and to express, you know, biological life and make you feel like you're in a fluid environment. And the music was also wonderful. It's only been mentioned, I think, in one review, or one reviewer kind of went into a paragraph talking about the music. But, you know, in sound, it sounds like just very kind of, you know, basic synthesized music. But having listened to the songs over and over for hundreds of hours as I was testing the game, I have to say they really grew on me, and I never got tired of them. And so the composer, the name's Logan Middleton here in Austin, he worked on 5 or 6 versions of the dynamic track that kicks in when you start to lose. Yeah. And it was one of those things where it's like, it was kind of a one-off idea we had, like, hey, let's just try to do some dynamic music that kind of is organic and incorporates some of the body sounds, either breathing or heartbeat or something, and just kind of make it all mesh together in rhythm with the music. And it was a hard thing to pull off. And everything was kind of coming close, but just never quite feeling right. And then he kept at it. I was like, okay, we need to put a lot of time in this. It's fine if you want to pull out if you want, but he kept at it until we got a track that I think works really well and feels right somehow. Some kind of magic he pulled off.
Like you say, after playing the game a fair bit, and I'm still going back to it now to try and improve my techniques, that I haven't actually got, as you say, I haven't got bored of the music. I think another thing, it's not actually in your face. I mean, I think the sound effects are a little more prevalent in the audio.
Yeah, and you know, Logan was really you know, aware that the music needed to mesh with the game, and you know, might not need to be the foreground element at all the time, and so, you know, I think he looked at the game really closely and thought, figured out what it needed, and did different tracks based on the different moods of levels. Some of them are a little slower; you do a little more construction to win them, and others are just more just, you know, blast away. It came out really, really well.
Going back to the plot a little bit, it's you say you're anally retentive when it comes to research. I think I read that in the Killscreen Daily interview you did. Mm-hmm. But someone who said they were a biochemist lamented, what did they say? Many of the futuristic fallacies that this game presents, with terms like prion gel, and also they said that it sort of breaks the immersion for them, being a biochemist. Now, I don't take this too seriously. Consider that most games fall back on unexplained technology or magic just for gameplay convenience. But I wonder if you have a specific response to that sort of criticism.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I mean, this is, I think, a pretty bold conceit that you would have, you know, sentient nanobots inside of a body. So there has to be some stretching going on to explain how they work. So I might fall back on that excuse. And, you know, and there's, I think a lot of things are not fully explained, like the prion gel in particular. And the really real notion there is that there's fragments of proteins being spread on the membrane that are allowing antibodies to attach, right?
Yeah.
So I think the thinking behind some of these terms is pretty valid. You know, it's kind of, you know, I think it's well thought out in terms of how it would work. You know, like you wouldn't really spread the antibodies. The way it works inside the body is that they attach to certain targets, right? Mm. So I think, you know, I think there's plenty of good thinking in there, but, you know, I'm not a biochemist, so I'm sure I've missed it in some respects, and I'm sure I have this novel in the trunk of under by my bed, although I'm making that image up, but every author seems to have some novels in a trunk somewhere that's based on biotech. So I went really deep into research for that, and in particular into genetics, and I imagine the reaction might be the same when it comes out. I'm gonna probably put it out myself. It's been bouncing around publishers and it's been close at a couple places, but it'll come out someday soon, and we'll see if I get a similar reaction from biochemists on that.
Going back to Deus Ex, not specifically, but I can see probably you want to trade on that. You know, it's your biggest byline. I was a writer on Deus Ex, and it's the thing that will grab attention for you. But at the same time, you probably just don't want to be defined by that one game. And at some point, you want to be remembered for, say, the guy who created Living Voxels or something like that. I mean, how do you have that sort of, you know, conundrum about, you know, yes, I like being Deus Ex guy, but on the other hand, I don't?
Yeah, I think I have a personality complex in that I'm never happy with who I am currently, and always trying to reach for something else. You know, in every job, you know, in the world, every kind of business, you get a role, right, and you get a definition, and then, you know, you're kind of in that kind of box, and it's never felt completely comfortable for me, because I kind of have both the technical side and the creative side, and it was this wonderful joy when I first left being an engineer, because I was lead programmer on a game, and then kind of left that off and was kind of contracting, doing software development until Deus Ex came along. And then I was in a company and had a business card that said writer, and I was sitting in a chair kind of flipping through novels and writing dialogue. And I remember the first month or so I was at Ion Storm, I'd hear some programmers talking about a problem, like the dialogue's breaking up or cutting out, or, you know, some problem with the sound. And I would just get this, my hair would stand up on the back of my neck thinking, oh man, they're going to come talk to me and I'm going to have to dig into the code. Because that had been my role at other places. I was the guy who could figure out these problems. And then gradually I realized, wait a minute, no, I just have to kind of read these books and write some dialogue. This is wonderful. So I really enjoyed being a writer, and I could be completely content just being, you know, the writer of kind of deep, complex RPG type games. Mm. May very well do that in my later years. But at the same time, you know, I feel like I can do more, you know, in terms of, you know, game creation and invention and construction, design, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I may not be the best at any of those fields. I mean, writing may be the one where that's the sweet spot for me. That's where I've gone deepest creatively. And games may be the media where I really understand the medium, where I understand the structure really well enough to apply the creative writing. But yeah, I want to stretch. I've always had this urge to stretch. I got a degree in math and a degree in English, and I was always most content when I was on the subway going off to another university to study the other thing, whatever I wasn't currently enrolled to study. I always felt like special that I was going off to do something else, like to study chaos mathematics, when really I was an English major, you know.
Just going off on a bit of a tangent then, I know on the Killscreen Daily interview you talked about submitting to the machine culture and how deadly that can be for the soul. I mean, you were talking in context of, you know, working at a desk and all day, and, you know, everything is done through the computer. That technology is changing everything. Plenty of sci-fi, especially TV, will only focus on, say, a handful of technological aspects, because trying to, you know, model, predict the enormous cultural shifts you get out of new technology it's almost impossible to extrapolate. I mean, you've got the internet, Facebook, Google. There's a sense that the internet and everything like that, it's changing how we experience everything. Now, I don't see that kind of stuff depicted too much in games. I know it's something that's in your mind about where future technology is taking us. Have any ideas where this is all headed?
Well, that's a big question. I wish I could have prepared an answer for that one. It's getting to the point where things do move so fast that they're a bit unpredictable. I couldn't have predicted what YouTube is like today, right? When YouTube first came out, and I had some aspiring filmmaker friends, it came out, and they were basically saying, "Hey, check this site out. This is a great place for young filmmakers to put their films up and get noticed and make their mark." And my vision for it, like theirs, was, "Hey, this is where all the indie filmmakers are going to go and share their stuff." I didn't realize it was going to be, all of America's funniest videos and all of the home videos of everybody on the planet, in one place. And, I was just sitting down this evening with my daughter watching the funny videos she's found. And they're kind of, we were looking at music videos, kind of spoof music videos tonight. And all of them made just in somebody's house. You just see their house and their refrigerator and their backyard. And then kind of a popular song being spoofed. And it just seems like people are so more tightly connected now in a way that it's just kind of hard to fathom what the result of that will be. I mean, you kind of see things happening in the Arab world, partly, driven by social media and whatnot. And it's just moving so fast that it's hard to really grasp how the nature of interaction between people is changing. To segue into another concept, I'm really attracted to the idea of the singularity, the notion that technology will begin moving so quickly because machines will be able to kind of start redesigning themselves that human beings won't really even be able to understand how fast things are moving. I think some of that fantasy may be a bit of a fantasy in terms of, it's one of those ideas that international or interstellar space travel that you kind of eventually science will reach the point where you realize, well, it's not really going to get moving that fast. We're going to level off or whatnot. But it's a kind of attractive idea that things might continue to accelerate to the point where it's just people, organic life just can't really grasp what's happening. And that's how it feels. Maybe just because I'm getting older, that's how it's starting to feel.
I know, trying to keep on top of all this stuff sometimes can be a bit of an effort. I like the old days when we didn't have email. I just used to walk down the street and talk to people.
Yeah, I'm starting to make some statements like that myself, which scare me because, I've always been a technical fiend. I love technology and learning about the newest stuff. But it's getting to where, things surprise me now and then. I don't understand how things work. Social media still kind of freaks me out a bit. I don't really care for Facebook too much. I've tried to embrace it, but then I seldom want to put anything out there because I've got, 100 or so people of all different types, family, friends, business associates, all in one pool. And then I don't want to take all the effort to put them into some structure where I only send some things to some people and some to others. I think the singularity may be happening for me, but maybe not for everybody else, but it's starting to happen for me.
I was thinking about what you were saying about how you never thought YouTube would turn into what it is now. I think it's like the sort of AOL effect. Back in the 90s when the internet was just, something that the public would use. Just started to take shape, and there was lots of people who had built up, with mainly people in universities and stuff like that, and then everybody started coming onto it from the ordinary public, and it was America Online, AOL brought a lot of people in, and people used to moan about, oh God, it's another AOLer, screwing things up for the ordinary people of the internet. And except that is the future, that the ordinary person on the internet, maybe even shit talking and saying whatever comes off the top of their head, that is the future. So take any social media idea and look at the the academic aspects of it, and then just add in ordinary people, and that's what your future is. So YouTube goes from indie filmmaking into something like, America's funniest videos.
Yeah, I guess William Gibson always used to say that the street finds its own uses for things. And I guess there's a kind of a non-gritty kind of low culture side to that where, you think, as academics or creative people, you see something like YouTube and you just imagine the high-minded uses it can be put to. But once you open the doors, then it's just you're in everybody's living room. And And I see my kids just watching other kids play with their toys. You know, those are the kind of videos they watch. And it's just, you know, everybody's in everybody else's space all of a sudden.
Just going to round off with a couple of last questions. First of all, on your writing. So you wrote one novel, I understand, called, is it Demiurge?
Yeah, I think that's how it's pronounced. Not entirely sure, but I think so.
So that's I think that's available on your website at the moment, isn't it? Is there any other writing you've done over the years, which I haven't seen any references to it, but have you written short stories or anything for magazines and things like that?
Yeah, so most of my fiction writing happened just before I got into the game business. So I wrote that book, and that was really an exercise I put in front of myself to write a mainstream plot-driven novel. Because coming out of academia, I was, you know, very much interested in literary fiction, and still am. I think I'll end up writing very staid kind of New Yorker stories when I get older, for no doubt when I retire. You know, so I mean, I love those kind of just deeply psychological stories with lots of, you know, history to them or internal monologue, that kind of thing. But you know, I did that novel to make myself tell a story, you know, have a plot, and it's a detective story. And anyway, it's successful in some ways. A lot of my close family and friends still think that's the best thing I've written because it's kind of fun to read. It kind of moves, you know, it's got a nice plot and everything. But at the same time, I was doing a lot of short fiction, trying out different things, and really ended up at the end of that phase in my late 20s doing some near-future science fiction where I finally felt like my art was coming together where I wanted it to be. And so a couple of those stories made it into literary magazines. There's this one called Kodoki, or Kodokai, I think might be how you say it. It's set in Russia, in Kazakhstan, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And it's a space worker, one of the engineers from the workers. His economic livelihood's fallen apart because of the fall of the Soviet Union, and some of the people are returning to nomadic lifestyles and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's about technology, but it's sort of, you know, present time or near future time. And so for me, that's where I think my writing was coming together. And after that, and we would talk about, you know, my writing pursuits after Deus Ex, basically during and after Deus Ex, I was working on this biotech novel I mentioned. Mm. And so I took that aesthetic and applied it to a pretty, you know, hefty novel, which, you know, I worked on for several years, and at this point, having a family and having a job, moving around the country and stuff. So, you know, years kind of started to stretch out. Didn't have quite as much time to crank out a short fiction or whatnot. But, you know, I've continued to write short stories. Had a piece in, nonfiction piece in Salon a few years back. And I've been getting to the point now where I'm ready to circle back to the fiction, kind of close out that novel, put it out in some form. It's been sitting in a... I like to think it's sitting on a corner of somebody's desk in New York, where it passed through the what they call the first reader at a yeah. company. It's probably sitting in a closet somewhere. But you know, I think I'm probably about ready to let that run its rounds in terms of looking for agents and publishers and put it out in some form, and then move on to the next thing.
All right, so I guess we'll look out for that novel in the next 5 years sometime.
Yeah.
So the final question is basically, are there any games you'd recommend? Anything that's your favorites, or something shiny that's caught your attention in recent times?
Well, the truth is I've been so busy coding that I haven't actually played a whole lot of games lately. But the one series of games that I've been enamored with in recent times has been the stuff that's come out of Quantic Dream. So the Indigo Prophecy was the previous game, and then Heavy Rain.
Yeah.
And so I've played a bit of Heavy Rain now. I'm finally getting time to get back to games. So I've played it a little bit. And I think, you know, everything they're doing, you can quibble with the design and exactly how it is executed and works. But I like the fact that they're trying to put play into a more, you know, domestic, real-life setting. So, you know, the sequence at the beginning where you interact with your wife and she asks you to do something and you go try to do it, and then you clumsily break something or knock something over and she scolds you. That felt very real to me. It seemed like I've lived that before. And it was great to play something like that. You know, you just don't, you know, I teach this, you know, writing course at the University of Texas, and really the kind of takeaway of all the readings we do is that you need to let the players play your content, or you're not really writing an interactive story. You know, you're not engaging the player like the medium requires you to, or at least calls you to. I'm really happy with the things they're trying to do. There's also an interaction at the sink, you know, where you go, if you do it right, you get a more of an intimate interaction with your wife. And if you don't, then you kind of just move on and the conversation continues. Those kind of subtle, small story moments, you know, bringing those into the player's hands, into their controller, I think is a great direction to move in. So we can create games that are, you know, emotional experiences for, you know, I'd say grown-ups, but I think anyone, even younger players, I think would appreciate games that let them, you know, live the life of the player character.
All right. I think I haven't played Indigo Prophecy or Fahrenheit, as it was once called, nor Heavy Rain. I did play the first game they made, which is Omicron, which is interesting. It's I don't know if you played Omicron?
No, I should actually go back and play that and see kind of, so I can get the full evolution of their thinking.
It's an odd game. It does some interesting things. We're creating a sort of like a big open world to some extent, but it kind of goes down that sort of mistake of, well, it's a big open empty world and only very, you know, very a few precise hot spots in it actually do anything, you know, depending on the story. It's an interesting game. I recommend it for nostalgic value, I think, you know, if you're interested in how Quantic Dream got to where they are today.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in that. You know, it's all this stuff is a stab in the dark, right? Especially in the kind of stuff they're doing, which is very experimental. You just don't know when you start out. Honestly, I'll digress a bit. Even for a shooter or RPG type game, you know, you start a project out and you really don't know if it's going to be fun or if it's going to work until you're into it and into building it, actually. And that's why so many projects never make it out the door. You know, they have the concept phase and then the vertical slice phase and so on to see if the project is really going to pan out. So it's great to see, you know, a company like that come along that can do something so different than what other people are doing and actually make it a commercial success. So they're my idols in some ways. I also look up to Tim Schafer. Yeah, it's getting late here. Two glasses of wine and a bucket of espresso beans is not working for me. But yeah, I mean, I think if I could, pick a couple idols, I think those guys are two of my idols.
All right, well, I think that's a good time to wrap it up. Thank you very much, Sheldon, for spending your time with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.